les Français dans la recherche d'une paix universelle.
How dare you continue to look away?
En fait, je ne rêvais pas d'une paix dans le monde. Je rêvais d'une nouvelle organisation qui puisse, elle, contribuer à une paix dans le monde.
Les entretiens de l'Observatoire, un podcast du groupe de recherche sur l'action multilatérale.
Bonjour à toutes et à tous. Bienvenue dans les entretiens de l'Observatoire du multilatéralisme et des organisations internationales, un podcast qui vous est proposé par le GRAM, le groupe de recherche sur l'action multilatérale. Je m'appelle Chiara Ruffard et aujourd'hui, j'ai le plaisir de m'entretenir avec Vanessa Newby pour parler de comment un des outils les plus importants du multilatéralisme, le maintien de la paix, marche en pratique sur le terrain et en particulier sur la notion de crédibilité et pourquoi elle est importante pour les relations internationales ainsi que pour les opérations de paix. Vanessa Newby est maître de conférence auprès de l'Institut of Security and Global Affairs auprès de l'Université de Leiden. Elle a publié de nombreux travaux sur le maintien de la paix, les institutions informelles, les questions de genre et le Moyen-Orient, en particulier le Liban. Vanessa, bienvenue parmi nous. Welcome, Vanessa. Today, we are going to discuss your most recent article, which has just been published by Global Governance in 2022. The article is entitled Offering the Carrot and Hiding the Stick, Conceptualizing Credibility in UN Peacekeeping. The article is fantastic, and it's a deep dive into the concept of credibility as understood and practiced by UN peacekeeping. So let me start by asking, why is credibility so important for UN peacekeeping, Vanessa?
Thank you, Chiara. Well, I think the first question is to ask if credibility is important or not, and to whom and in what ways, which in part is what my article is trying to unpack. So credibility is mentioned as a second order success factor in the capstone document, which is the 2008 handbook on United Nations multidimensional peacekeeping operations. But in that publication, credibility is defined very much in terms of the need to use deterrent force. But what my article also brings to the fore is that there's a larger question to be answered about credibility more broadly, which I'd like to mention first, if that's all right. Because what we find in IR currently is that we have two literatures, a realist one on deterrence and balancing, and a liberal one on cooperation. Credibility is used in both of these literatures to advance theories about outcomes, historically or attempts to be predictive. But the concept itself is never discussed. Furthermore, because these two literatures prioritize different things, the question of audiences is never really examined. So what should a state be building a reputation for credibility on? And is it with the same audience? So Daniel Dresner has remarked on this, saying, countries should develop a reputation for what exactly? Can a reputation for toughness be reconciled with a reputation for compliance with international law? Does reputation in one issue area spill over into other issue areas? If states are speaking to the same audiences about both deterrence and cooperation, then the problem of reputation that Dresner raises above becomes pertinent. I think because these literatures don't talk very much to each other, credibility has been left to its own devices as a concept. And so very few people have tried to develop it. Now, the peacekeeping environment actually brings out this conundrum very strikingly. So my reason for using peacekeeping as a context in which to examine credibility is because here you have one audience and two potentially opposing goals, the need for the use of deterrent force and the need for the cultivation of cooperation. Hence, this context enables us to unpack what credibility looks like as a concept in and of itself. So in other words, if we say, oh, lots of boots on the ground will win a peace operation credibility for deterrence, which, by the way, is precisely what some authors do say, then the other half of that equation needs to be, okay, but what does that heavy presence do to the peace operation's ability to foster local cooperation? Does more boots on the ground mean more credibility for local cooperation? I would argue not necessarily, because this position then is making assumptions about the level of local support for the peace operation and how that plays out on the ground. So, for example, as a local civilian, maybe I like the idea of peace, and maybe I broadly support the goals of the peace operation. I may also dislike some of the armed groups at play, but I might support others. So how does blanket deterrence then win local cooperation in that context? So the missing element here is signaling, right? How do troops or states signal their willingness to deter and cooperate simultaneously with the same audience? Now, given the vast cultural differences within peacekeeping forces and between peacekeeping forces and the local population, is there any way we can do this?
Fantastic, Vanessa. Thank you so much for this very extensive answer. So based on what you just said, could you perhaps elaborate a bit more on how peacekeeping works? And why is credibility so important to understand how peacekeeping works?
Well, the issue with peacekeeping is that unlike a regular military force, although an invading army would probably tell you that it does need to do this, but in peacekeeping in particular, there is a huge need to win local support for the mission. And of course, try not to kill people. So local cooperation is regarded as critical to reduce local attacks on peacekeeping forces. In fact, only a few weeks ago, we had the tragic incident whereby an Irish unarmed peacekeeper from the UNIFIL mission was shot dead in a village in South Lebanon. This kind of tragic loss should be avoidable when you have local cooperation with the mission and consent for its presence. So the purposes of building credibility for cooperation are first to reduce security escalations and confrontations with national and subnational audiences, and to establish the foundations of a sustainable peace by taking steps to build inclusive institutions. But how does a peace operation signal its willingness to cooperate with national and subnational actors? What behaviors indicate that it's an honest partner capable of making credible commitments? I'll talk more about this in a bit. Now, in peacekeeping, deterrence refers to the capacity and willingness of a peace operation to use force in defense of the mandate. So the purpose basically in peacekeeping is to deter violence in all its forms. But again, how does a peace operation signal its resolve to use force when it considers using force necessary? But to answer your second question about why understanding credibility is important to understand in peacekeeping more broadly, well, that's because the several gaps in the literature remain. Credibility has often been used to justify the ends, but the means have never really been unpacked. So what I mean by that is statements are made in the literature about needing a large number of troops to demonstrate credibility in peacekeeping. And by that, I mean credibility in deterrence. But the fact is that a peacekeeping force is not the same as a national military force that comes under a unified command and control, and that can hopefully be relied upon to perform in a similar way. So in that scenario, a large number of troops would most certainly be seen as more threatening than a small number. But in peacekeeping, we know that different nationality contingents behave in and patrol in very different ways. So it's not enough just to say a large number of peacekeepers indicates credibility. It doesn't. Troops need to signal their willingness to credibly, or their resolve to use force to deter actors who might want to be violent. Okay, so it's understanding the how rather than the what.
Great.
And then how a peace operation develops credibility for cooperation is a second gap in the literature, because it's really currently quite under-researched. So the kind of behaviors that signal credibility, such as the provision of information, are definitely mentioned in the literature, but only usually in passing, with some small exceptions, which I'll talk about possibly later. But until my article came along, these really hadn't been unpacked in any meaningful way. So I guess what I'm saying is my article does, apart from raise the curly question of what is credibility as a concept, it also asks, are there signaling behaviors that a peacekeeping force can use to indicate their willingness to cooperate with the local population or to deter violence? And can we come up with some kind of classification that would be of service, of use to peacekeepers?
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Relating to this also, I mean, a wealth of scholarship, of literature, has found that peacekeeping works, mostly thanks to deterrence. But you criticize all those arguments as well. What is the problem with deterrence?
Well, first off, the use of force is heavily prescribed in UN peacekeeping. So the idea that one should use force to bulldoze a peace agreement has empirically only been shown to work in limited cases, in Kosovo, for example. I think temporality is important here. Sometimes a brief show of force is needed, but anecdotally, most peacekeepers will tell you the last thing you want to do when confronted with trouble on the ground is bring out your gun, because it usually only serves to escalate the problem. There's also the argument, of course, that once you start to use force extensively, you become part of the fight or another party in the fight. And that was shown, as we know, very clearly in Somalia. So there's a good chance that using force will give you more problems, not less. Now, where this gets very hazy, of course, is around the issue of the protection of civilians and how to use force in this situation, where protection of innocent civilians must be paramount. But the point I'm trying to make is that while the literature has found that oftentimes large numbers of troops can act as a deterrent, and this has been connected to the success of a mission, I don't think it's quite as simple as that. And when we consider how long the stabilization missions in Africa, the big ones like MINUSMA, have been around, where the use of force is allowed, I think we can agree that the use of force does not seem to be a quick route to the success of an overall peacekeeping operation.
Absolutely. And you also talk about it at length in your article. So can you tell us, more in general, why is force futile then in UN peacekeeping?
Well, I talk about this in the article, and I'm really building a lot and should give credit to the work of Lisa Howard as much as anything. And John Carlsrod, of course, has also talked a bit about this in relation to the stabilization missions. And I heartily agree with both of them. I think the biggest challenge in attempting to use force in peace operations is fundamentally the inability to provide security guarantees. Weak command and control, rotating troops, fuzzy rules of engagement, and quite simply, the large areas of operation many peace operations cover means that making a firm security guarantee is not possible. So peacekeepers need to find other ways of interacting with the local population to build support for the work of the mission and prevent needless attacks from hostile populations on the mission itself, simply to function. You know, basic functioning such as patrolling needs to happen in relative safety. So Lisa Howard contends in her book, Power in Peacekeeping, that inducement and persuasion work just as well as coercion. And her rationale is largely based on the evidence that most peace operations use inducement and persuasion more than coercion because of the issues I've mentioned previously that arise when doing so. And I agree with Lisa on this. My research on the UNIFIL mission convinced me that if a peace operation wants to even function in a semi-hostile environment, then the regular use of force is simply not possible, as it usually only triggers more violence. I would say that I do not think inducement through the use of material benefits is the only way to obtain local cooperation. It is possible and necessary to build cooperative relationships with local civilians and stakeholders at the same time. So civil-military relations on the ground are also very important, as well as civil affairs.
So your research is not only theoretically sophisticated, it's also very useful for policymakers. What can UN peacekeeping leadership do to ensure that the mission is uniformly credible across sectors?
So where my article goes into quite a lot of detail, and it's going to be a bit difficult to talk about this without, you know, the diagram in front of you. So I will try and keep this as simple as possible, but I encourage the readers to look at the show notes where the diagram will be in the article, which is fully open access, if they want to understand this a little better. So I'll try and talk on this issue without hopefully confusing the audience. So what I do in the article, in the second part of the article, is to unpack credibility as a concept, first and foremost, and unpack the signaling behaviors required for the two types of credibility you want to win, which are for deterrent purposes and for cultivating cooperation. So the first step, if you like, in this process is to break down the concept of credibility into a model that distinguishes between capability, which includes, for example, patrolling equipment, but strong command and control, and functional structure. I then separate that out from the second element of credibility, which I term resolve, and this comprises the signaling behaviors that indicate resolve, like intention. So the model of credibility in the article breaks it into two categories: capability, i.e. the material capacity, and resolve, which is signaling. And then if we leave the material capacity aside and focus on resolve, I then create two separate categories of behavior: signaling for deterrence and signaling for cooperation. And it's here that I think that policymakers can benefit from what I've written, because I really break down those two categories into types of behavior that troops can use to signal their willingness to cooperate in specific environments or their willingness to deter. So from my perspective, of course, in my so-called ivory tower, I would envisage or hope that this paper would be of use to policymakers, whereby they could look at what I've suggested and possibly incorporate that more deeply in their training models, but also possibly if they ever do get around to revising the capstone document, which, you know, was written in 2008. So to just give you an example, and I'm not going to go on about this too much because I do think it's too complicated if you're not looking at the chart. But if we take deterrence for a moment, I provide three major subcategories of behavior. Now, from an academic point of view, this won't come as a surprise in that I talk about the provision of information and repeated interaction and something I call responsiveness. Now, any IR scholar will know that the provision of information and repeated interaction are regarded as essential behaviors to signal cooperation between states. But in my model, I prefer to treat these behaviors as of subcategories, within which I house more specific behaviors that can be elucidated. So, for example, repeated interaction might include regular checkpoints, and the provision of information might include an overt show of weapons. So these are ways that peacekeepers can transmit their intention through signaling. And there's no reason why that can't be done by any nationality battalion. So it provides some kind of go-to format for how you might want your posture to seem when you go out into the field, depending on the context. And then responsiveness I've used to essentially cover off on the need for peacekeeping troops to be seen to be responding to their environment. So I talk about that more in the paper. I won't dwell on it here, but suffice to say that when troops are seen to demonstrate responsiveness to security incidents, I think that also indicates deterrence. And then on the other side of the equation, I discuss the behaviors that cultivate credibility for cooperation. And I use the same categories of behavior. So, for example, repeated interaction includes constant liaison with stakeholders. The provision of information includes honest updates on the conflict or conflicts or security situation. And responsiveness to the needs of the population includes things like providing emergency assistance, such as transport for a medical emergency. And I think when you think about cultivating cooperation in these more structured ways, it's easy to see how impartiality can also be exercised because there is a broader framework of behaviors that troops can deploy irrespective of the party.
Great. You're really giving us a lot of ideas about how peacekeeping actually works. And relating to this, the Cruz report on peacekeeping sparked a lively debate about the need to give ample opportunities for peacekeepers to use force. Your research seems to suggest a different approach, but it comes at the risk of getting peacekeepers stuck in the base when the environment is too volatile and the peacekeepers are too lightly armed. What would you recommend in those cases?
Well, we have a number of examples of different types of peace operations. But I think the example you give above is perhaps assuming that a heavily armed peace operation would sort of blast its way out of the base and into the local environment with a heavy use of force. But in the long term, what does that achieve? Now, we've seen some small successful uses of force in peacekeeping, but these have either been run directly by national military forces, such as the British in Sierra Leone, or with some exceptional short-term arrangements, such as in Eastern Congo with the Force Intervention Brigade. But what Lisa Howard and I and others are at pains to stress is that these kind of solutions don't seem to work in the long term. So the temporality issue I mentioned above, I think, remains relevant. And if you look at MONUSCO in the Congo, it's pretty clear that the use of force has not resolved the larger problems because the mission is still there after 20 odd years. So let's use a Star Wars analogy here. If you can stand it, and say that the Han Solo principle of using his space blaster to get himself out of tricky situations has a limited shelf life versus the Luke Skywalker approach of trying to talk his way out of trouble using his lightsaber as the last resort. Now, I'm not an expert on the larger African missions, but it seems to me that the use of force has not provided them with any more success in the long term. So to my mind, building cooperative relationships, in particular with key stakeholders at the regional and local level, is ultimately what's going to get you out of the base. And I think for me, the key element of building credibility for cooperation is to be honest. Don't tell them what they want to hear. Tell them how it is. Build a reputation for honesty, no matter what the circumstances. And those groups and institutions will eventually find your presence reassuring. Because at the very least, they have some confidence that you're telling the truth about the situation. If you're able to develop that reputation, I think you've gone a long way to building your credibility across both dimensions, deterrence and cooperation.
Very, very clear. Thanks, Vanessa. In this article, as well as in your 2018 book, you talk extensively about positive peacekeeping. What is it? And what would it take for the international community to implement it?
Yeah, I mean, this is an idea I raised at the end of the article. So as you know, it's not something I've thought about too deeply yet. But I wanted to put it in because I like the idea of it. For me, positive peacekeeping has to be about prioritizing building a positive peace more broadly, rather than a negative peace, the absence of violence. And I think that building a positive peace begins with building honest relationships with local communities that critically are inclusive of multiple audiences. Now, obviously, that approach requires a multitude of actors. But I think police keepers, i.e. peacekeepers who conduct policing in peace operations, are actually in a particularly good position to reduce structural violence in the societies in which they work and build positive peace within communities. And I think perhaps this point is underexplored at this current time.
I would agree with you on that. You're an expert in international relations, but you also have a long-lasting interest for the Middle East, Lebanon in particular. Why is it so important to study peacekeeping in the Middle East?
I do have regional expertise on the Middle East. I've spent around 4 years or more living and working in the region, and I am an Arabic speaker, but which sometimes I think ends up with me being pigeonholed as a Lebanon specialist. But my interest in the Eastern Mediterranean is that, broadly speaking, which includes, you know, parts of the Arab world, is that there are several older missions that still have a lot to teach us about how peacekeeping works in practice, and they're often ignored. So I'm talking here about UNFISIP in Cyprus, UNIFIL in Lebanon, UNSO in Israel, Palestine, and UNDOF in the Golan Heights. Now, these missions have a wealth of experience of deconfliction on the ground. More importantly, peaceful deconfliction strategies that I would argue are the kind of practices we want to see more of in peacekeeping. And I think examining these practices is something that needs to be explored.
Now, as you probably know, here we at the Observatoire, we are quite curious people. So could you tell us a bit more about the rest of your research agenda? In particular, you have a book under contract with Oxford University Press. Congratulations on that. For a book about smaller, forgotten peacekeeping operations in the Middle East. What is the book about, and why do you want to study those missions?
Well, my next book for Oxford is all about how peacekeepers deconflict security incidents on the ground, and specifically about how they do this either non-violently or using extreme restraint on the use of violence. So the book is really drawing on the expertise of former peacekeepers from these four missions to unpack and elucidate this topic. Now, this is largely due to what I see as a lacuna of scholarship on how peacekeepers think and do. You yourself have written a fantastic paper on this very topic, more than one, actually. So this social turn that I know you and I are interested in exploring, my book, I would consider very much part of that body of work. And the aim is to expose the meaning-making process that guides peacekeeper deconfliction practices on the ground by asking the question, how do UN peacekeepers interpret their local security environment? Now, the theoretical approach I use is one that I, as I've said, I think remains quite underdeveloped currently in peacekeeping research, which is a sociological one. And this book draws on social constructionist thinking, using an abductive approach to examine meaning making in UN peacekeeping, specifically at the level of patrolling peacekeepers. So the following sub-questions are asked in the book. How do context and situatedness shape peacekeeper interpretations of security incidents? How are peacekeeper perceptions of their agency over outcomes constituted? And what narratives do peacekeepers draw on to explain their deconfliction practices? So the goal of this book is to develop a social theory of peacekeeping practice, which shows how context, situatedness, narratives, and agency co-constitute action in peacekeeping, and specifically examining how peacekeepers deconflict on the ground in these missions. And to answer your question more broadly about why these missions, because they have experience over decades of minor, so-called minor security incidents and of deconflicting those. And I think the point I really want to make here is that, you know, any incident, security incident, can be minor and then can escalate. And I think the case, the tragic case recently in South Lebanon, indicates that so clearly, because, you know, the peacekeepers were simply trying to drive out of a village that they were lost in. There was no other purpose to their being there, and it ended in the death and serious injury of two peacekeepers. So any incident can be minor, and it's how you deconflict that prevents it from becoming major. And I think this is really underexplored more broadly, and that's what I'm trying to talk about. And given the wealth of experience in Cyprus and Lebanon, you know, these really deep, intractable land-based conflicts, I think they will provide us a lot of understanding of what goes on at that level of patrolling.
Absolutely. So we are now nearing the end of this fabulous little podcast. So I'm going to ask you the million-dollar question, perhaps. So if you were to mention the three most urgent topics to explore in both the academic and policy sphere, what would they be?
Well, I'm not sure you're going to like my answer, Kiara, because I could argue that all topics are urgent in the sense that we don't know what we don't know, right? So I think it's hard to identify or produce a concrete hierarchy of needs in IR or policy. But what concerns me right now is what I see as the shrinking of women's rights across the world, from the US to Afghanistan to Iran and beyond. And I think what bothers me the most, or not the most, or but equally, is that what I see is that even in the West, there is a kind of implicit and invisible acceptance in discourse that it's understandable that women should be discriminated against, as if somehow our history of subjugation is a rationale for the continuation of that in some way. I find this remarkable and deeply concerning in this day and age. And as someone in education, I think more energy needs to go into making our curricula more inclusive and exposing alternative views on how the world works. Of course, exposing the subaltern view, but also exposing the gendered lens through which we view global problems. Now, given we're 50% of the population or even 51%, I don't think that's an unreasonable request. We currently have a great deal of philosophical literature on how men think the world works. It's time to challenge those assumptions rather than be socialized by them. So for me, it isn't really that any one issue in and of itself is so crucially important, but how we treat or examine each issue currently is problematic and important to rectify.
Thank you so much, Vanessa, for answering all our questions. We wish you best of luck for your next endeavors, and we look forward to reading your upcoming book. Again, many congratulations on this fantastic article. Nous voilà alors arrivés au terme de ce podcast consacré à la crédibilité dans les Nations Unies. Merci beaucoup, chère Vanessa, pour cet échange. Merci aussi aux auditrices et aux auditeurs pour leur écoute. Et merci aussi à l'Observatoire pour produire ce podcast qui s'inscrit dans l'axe multilatéralisme-sécurité que nous coordonnons avec Sonia Le Gourielec, Charles Sennenbaum et Camille Bayet. Pour trouver toutes les références et bien d'autres sur le site de l'Observatoire du multilatéralisme et des organisations internationales. Donc n'hésitez pas à chercher sur notre site. À très bientôt et merci.
How dare you continue to look away?
En fait, je ne rêvais pas d'une paix dans le monde. Je rêvais d'une nouvelle organisation qui puisse, elle, contribuer à une paix dans le monde.